From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom wants to change how we fund the homelessness fight, but is his way the right way? Some in Sacramento don't think so. Plus, the destruction of a lacquer factory in Banning, California spells big trouble for the resurgent vinyl record business.
It really leaves a big question mark as to what the industry is going to do now.
The Apollo plant provided about 80% of the market. That and more is all coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Coming up on the show, we profile Rachel Rossi, a former public defender who's running for district attorney of Los Angeles County. Plus, we continue our special report, Stuck, Inside California's Housing Crisis, with a look at just how much landlords can get away with despite chronic problems in their buildings.
We give landlords and slumlords protections that no other business has.
We will get to that in about 15 minutes, but first, to the state's homeless crisis. Last month, Governor Gavin Newsom proposed carving out more than $1.4 billion in the budget to fight homelessness. It's a lot of money with a lot of promise behind it, but a new report by the state's Legislative Analyst Office looked into the plan, and it said that it doesn't present a, quote, clear strategy, and that it was less likely to have a, quote, meaningful ongoing impact on the problem. To help us break down this report and assess what local governments think about this plan, we have Gary Painter with us. He's director of the Homelessness Policy Research Institute at USC. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you for having me today.
Thanks. According to that report, what was not clear about the governor's strategy?
Well, I think what the legislative analyst wanted to emphasize is that there is not a long-term strategy attached to this particular budget allocation of around $1.4, $1.5 billion. Instead, this kind of represents a series of investments that the state government has done as one-time measures. So we've had some emergency measures, prevention measures, and those kinds of things. And this is more of the same, funneling money into two particular kinds of programs. Both are related to people experiencing homelessness that have health needs.
So the report is noting that this cash infusion is just a one-time deal, so that the impact will be unlikely to be long-term. Is that right?
Well, I think the hope for many lawmakers that I've spoken to is that they will be able to craft a long-term strategy, but they recognize that it's going to take time to develop such a strategy. As we've seen with the kind of failure of SB 50 to, you know, kind of help address some of the issues of where density could happen in our housing market, we really have two significant problems that we're facing, and they're intertwined. We need to adjust the housing system for the 21st century so that it actually can meet the demands of Californians. And we also need to address and provide help for people who need it most and people who are experiencing homelessness. These are both long-term issues, and, you know, we need the resources that the government's budget allocates. There are definitely people, especially older people experiencing homelessness, that are going to benefit from this one-time infusion in terms of providing more board and care facility and other health interventions. We have programs like Housing for Health in Los Angeles, and this is going to ramp up those programs here in Los Angeles, but also statewide. These are all really needed. However, if it is only one time, it's not going to have a long-lasting impact.
Well, we wanted to hear from the governor about how he felt about this criticism and concerns. And his press secretary got back to us with this quote, "We strongly disagree with the assertion that emergency funding to fight homelessness should be spread thinly with less accountability and in keeping with business as usual. The governor's proposal aims to use the new fund as a catalyst for wraparound services to get people off the street and calls on locals to do the same." How aggressive would you say his plan is?
I wouldn't say that it's particularly aggressive. I think the comment that you just read just notes that he didn't want to give money to localities without any specific program in mind. And so that's why he focused on two particular kinds of programs that are necessary and can certainly help people experiencing homelessness. However, it's not enough for the size of the homeless population in California, and it doesn't address lots of other people who are experiencing homelessness who may not have specific kinds of health needs that are attached to this particular kind of funding.
Well, let's drill down on localities, the localities you just mentioned. Can you explain how the money in the proposed budget is intended to flow to local officials and what they think about how that would work?
So it's easiest to explain it in the context of Los Angeles, where I reside, because I know a little bit more about the ecosystem here. A number of years ago, and it was cited in the GAO report, a combination of public and philanthropic dollars were put together to create something called the Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool. This was for people who were experiencing homelessness who had health needs, and to be able to provide them in private rental housing and then attach services, wraparound services to them. Based on the success of that, that program has expanded here locally in Los Angeles County. And I think the governor has cited that as the kind of program that he feels like has proven successful and deems additional investment. So that's why $750 million of those dollars was targeted to programs like that. Some jurisdictions around the state may not have such a program in place, and so it might take them some time to actually implement that structure. And in part, maybe that's what the governor is trying to do, is to kind of incentivize a move in that direction to create programs like that. The Medi-Cal sorts of dollars are again, to really focus on people with acute health needs. And so, again, within our health systems, we have those programs in place, and that will enable those programs to be ramped up. But as I noted before, that's kind of two slices of the homeless population. It's a really important part of the homeless population. These are people who are most likely to be chronically homeless. However, there's a lot of other people experiencing homelessness that also need to be served.
Well, officials, local officials in cities with high homelessness rates, what kind of reception is the governor's plan getting from them?
Well, in many ways, any money is a welcome sight. There was actually concerns that the amount of money would be even much less than what was allocated. But if you ask local officials, they wish it was more, and they wish it was broader, and so that they could really have the ability to meet the needs of all of the homeless who are all of the people who are experiencing homelessness. So I think I think the next key steps is to say, okay, we needed that this year, but what about the long term, and to really develop a long term strategy, both to address the system and the people.
So tomorrow is the first hearing on the governor's budget plan and his plan for homelessness and the reception among state lawmakers. What are you hearing about that so far?
Well, I haven't heard anything different than the reception here locally is that they're glad that the governor is making concrete steps toward providing resources in proven programs for people experiencing homelessness. But I know that lawmakers really wish the governor had laid out a strategy that they could react to. I know that lawmakers are beginning to kind of circulate ideas and proposals around what that such a strategy would be that would actually change how we go about, for instance, on the housing market side, kind of looking at our planning processes at the state and locally, and also how one might provide a broader kind of resource base for people who are most housing insecure.
Gary, it sounds like both you and lawmakers don't think the governor's plan is quite aggressive enough. What is stopping it from being more innovative and more far-reaching? Money?
Well, it's partially money, but I think it's also, I think the governor is taking deliberate steps not to put something out there before he has a sense of what a long-term strategy actually might look like. And so while we did have the commission provide their initial recommendations, even those recommendations, as I read them, were not specific enough to necessitate a particular kind of action. So I think what we have in front of us is a lot of good ideas. Those good ideas, though, need to be brought together around a coherent plan. And then we have to look hard in the mirror and say, what kind of resources are necessary to execute this plan so that we can actually end homelessness in California?
So for you, as someone who studies homelessness and death, we only have a few seconds left, but I'm curious to what you think about the lawmakers' response to the homelessness crisis. So also not aggressive enough?
I think that people need to take some very clear steps and allow perhaps some localities to do more radical things that they think that they can do to reduce homelessness, and then allow some of those new ideas to percolate and then to infuse in the broader system. So yes, I think we need to start taking steps and not make the good the enemy of the great, or maybe I said that backwards, but I think oftentimes we don't do good things because we want to do the best thing. So we just need to take clear, decisive actions in order to address the homelessness crisis.
And also maybe look a little bit more locally. Gary Painter, Director of the Homelessness Policy Research Institute at USC. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, there is a lot of attention being paid to the presidential primary, but here in Los Angeles, it is not the only big race on the March 3rd ballot. The campaign for LA County District Attorney is drawing national attention. The fight over who will run the country's largest prosecutor's office is the latest chapter in a push to elect reformist DAs across the U.S. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale sat down with all three candidates, incumbent DA Jackie Lacey, former San Francisco DA George Cascone, and former public defender Rachel Rossi. Today we hear from Rossi.
Rachel Rossi is punctual, not common among politicians. She arrives at the KPCC studios well before our interview time. And I notice a few things instantly. Like me, she wears gold hoop earrings and identifies as Afro-Latina. So she wants to talk about that first.
Do you find that it's people want to kind of put you in a category?
Oh, yeah. People have
you black or are you Latina?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas Rossi is 36. She grew up in the San Gabriel Valley and graduated from Pepperdine Law School. Her parents are both immigrants. Her mom is from Greece and her dad is from the Dominican Republic.
That adds another layer of confusion for a lot of people. But I think it actually makes me a bridge builder because I fit into a lot of worlds.
Rossi spent 3 years working in the LA County Public Defender's Office, and then over 4 years as a federal public defender. She says being a public defender put her deep in the trenches of the criminal justice system. So she's seen how over 80% of jail inmates are black or brown, and how a third of them are struggling with mental health issues.
I think the most troubling thing as a public defender is walking into courtrooms every day and only seeing black and brown people locked up and chained at the ankle and at the waist. When everyone in that courtroom is walking into the courtroom every day and that's all they see, it becomes commonplace and it becomes the status quo.
Rossi describes one day on the job when she was representing a client arrested in a federal sweep of drug dealers.
And it was just rows and rows of just black men from Compton in a courtroom. And I wanted to scream and I wanted to say, doesn't this look wrong to someone here? But you can't. You can't really critique these larger scale problems that you see.
But she says as the top prosecutor, she could.
It's one of the areas in our system where there is almost unbridled discretion to not file a case.
Seema Ahmad is a trial attorney who was close with Rossi while they were both federal public defenders.
The word that comes to mind in thinking about Rachel is fierce compassion.
Ahmad says Rossi stood out in the office because of the close relationship she developed with her clients.
She's gonna fight for her clients. She's gonna make sure that there's no stone left unturned in a case.
Rossi says if she's elected DA, she'll focus on putting fewer people in prison. To do that, she says she'll end cash bail, decriminalize homelessness, and prosecute far fewer misdemeanors. She's also pledged to meet with the families of all victims of officer shootings and to use independent prosecutors to prevent bias in major use of force cases. She's also the self-described underdog candidate. And that's clear at her first town hall at the Big House, a community space in southeast LA. Rows of chairs sit, mostly empty. A spread of cookies and snacks sits, mostly untouched. There are maybe 20 people here. The few people here include Rossi's friends, community activists, and a few curious neighbors. But they're all ready for change.
We've been status quo for years.
A lot of candidates were run on being tough on crime, and we are now seeing the effects of that messaging.
We need a public defender in that office to change it.
Hey, everyone.
As Rossi takes questions, one man raises his hand over and over again. His name is Jerome Kitchen.
What is your plans on working toward being more transparent with victim family members and the community?
Kitchen tells me his godbrother was Jamel Moore, one of the two black men found dead at the home of high-profile Democratic donor Ed Buck. Kitchen protests regularly at DA Jackie Lacey's office. Lacey filed criminal charges against Buck last fall, 2 years after Moore's death. His family filed a lawsuit claiming that it took too long to prosecute Buck and that racial bias was behind the delay.
And she totally ignored our family.
At the town hall, Rossi only indirectly criticizes Lacey's handling of the case.
We need a district attorney that will finally begin to work for all communities and not some communities.
After hearing Rossi talk, Jerome Kitchen said he's impressed.
Sounds like she had your vote.
She absolutely has my vote.
That's one small victory for the underdog candidate. Covering public safety, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
Later in the week, we'll profile the other challenger in the race, former San Francisco DA George Gascon. You can learn a lot more about the DA race and everything else on the ballot by checking out our voter game plan at LAist.com. Coming up on Take Two, we're going to take a deep and a warning, a disturbing dive into a sprawling rental empire that spans counties and affects thousands upon thousands of low-income tenants. It's one of the state's biggest mega landlords with one of the poorest rental records. What are regulators doing about it? We have a series running this week about the rental market, and we're going to speak to investigative reporter Aaron Mendelson about it. Take Two in a few minutes. Stay with us. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Now, to a special report we're running all this week, a hard look at the bottom rung of the housing market, the rentals of last resort and the landlords who own them. We're calling the series Stuck, Inside California's Housing Crisis. Today, KPCC's Aaron Mendelson looks at what happens to a landlord when the very worst happens to a tenant. And a warning, content in this story may not be suitable for all listeners.
If you've heard of Oildale, it might be because country music legend Merle Haggard grew up there in a boxcar.
Put my head close to the window, watch Oildale fade away.
It's right across the Kern River from Bakersfield. Cheap rent draws people. People like Marissa and Angelica Rodriguez.
So at the time, I didn't understand anything. I was like, well, we need a spot.
That's Angelica, the big sister. They moved to Oildale in 2015. Angelica found a mobile home from a company called Palma Management, a company run by a man named Mike Niger and his family.
It obviously wasn't a good place to stay. Like, it wasn't at all.
The heater didn't work. Wires dangled from the ceiling. When they plugged something in, the outlet sparked. When they asked the landlord for repairs, they say they didn't get much help. But they tried to make do, make it home. Marissa and her daughter, Jenica, spent lots of time together.
She was, like, always a happy baby. Quiet, probably. Yeah, quiet, like me, too. But, like, we're always together, so, like, I didn't really worry about nothing because I always had her.
On January 24th, 2016, Marissa put Jenica to bed in a pink onesie. And then she and Lorenzo settled into the living room.
Me and my baby daddy were just watching TV, and then we end up falling asleep, and all I remember next is him waking me up, and then the whole trailer was on fire.
There's a baby trapped in there. The fire's bad.
There's a baby trapped inside the structure.
Marissa and Lorenzo, and then the firefighters and a sheriff's deputy, all tried to save Jenica. But it was too hot to run in. Lorenzo burned himself trying. Jenica Occhiano Lozano died that night. She was 5 months and 4 days old. The autopsy report said she died of smoke inhalation.
This is the only case I'm aware of where the negligence of a real estate licensee was so severe that it led to the loss of human life.
That's James Demas. He's an attorney for the California Department of Real Estate. His department investigated the fire. they found the mobile home where Jenica died was not supposed to be there. The management company Palma did not have a permit for it. The home also didn't have legally required smoke or carbon monoxide detectors.
When you have gross negligence resulting in the loss of human life, we have to speak honestly and truthfully about that.
Afterwards, in a legal case, a judge revoked the real estate licenses of two of the parties who rented the property, but not Palma's owner, Mike Niger. In another, the Kern County DA brought criminal charges for involuntary manslaughter against Palma management, but that case was dismissed. And in a separate civil case, Marissa and Angelica Rodriguez and Lorenzo Lozano sued. They settled with Palma for an undisclosed amount. Palma denied liability. Marissa, Jenica's mom, still grieves.
It still feels the same, like, when it happened. Like, when I talk about it, I cry because it hurts me. That's why I really try not to talk about it. But my feelings still feel the same, like, when I lost it, when all that was going through, I still feel the same.
Marissa brought a stuffed bunny rabbit and a small pink box with her to the interview. She kept the box close.
These are her ashes. And, well, ever since I got them, I've been having them, like, carry her around everywhere.
The space where Jenica died has another trailer on it now. Since the fire, Mike Niger's companies have bought up more properties in Oildale, and with thousands of rentals across California, from San Bernardino to Sacramento, they're some of the biggest low-income landlords around. After repeated attempts, Mike Niger declined an interview. His lawyer provided a statement that said, quote, "Palma Management cares about the communities and the people we serve." I'm Aaron Mendelson.
KPCC's Aaron Mendelson is here with us now to talk about this story and the bigger project he spent a year reporting on. Aaron, thanks for joining us. That story was an intense listen.
It was a heartbreaking story to report, Jesse, and to hear about from Jenica's mother. James Demas, the attorney you heard in the story from the Department of Real Estate, he said this case goes far, far beyond what his agency usually sees. It's really the worst case scenario of what can happen in the rental market when a landlord rents out unpermitted, dangerous housing to renters who don't have anywhere else to go. And this story is just one of many documented problems this management company and its corporate cousins have had. But the government agencies that do document these problems, they don't always talk to one another and connect the dots.
Well, Aaron, you've been trying to connect the dots with this story. What is the big picture here?
Yeah, after a year digging through public, government, and court documents, we have an estimate that Palma, the management company, and its majority shareholder, Mike Niger, they are connected to about 16,000 units. Several of their properties have been cited by government regulators and sued in court over dangerous conditions like lax security or bedbug and roach infestations. And we learned a significant barrier to effective regulation and accountability is that Palma and Niger are connected to more than 100 different businesses with different names. This is actually pretty common in real estate to have all these different LLCs and corporations, but it makes tracking the ownership and control of these properties really difficult. So it's not necessarily obvious if your landlord is a mega landlord, or if your landlord has a good track record or a bad one. Here's retired UCLA law professor Gary Blasey.
We give landlords and slumlords protections that no other business has. For example, if you compare the enforcement by the health department of restaurants with their inspection of apartments, it's a completely different world. I mean, they have a fantastic system for keeping track of restaurants.
Unlike with restaurants, there's no letter grade in the window for an apartment.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron, I'm thinking that with California being this massive state with hundreds of thousands of units, it's going to be hard to know who owns housing in the state, right? I mean, what do we know?
Not much, Josie. And researchers like Princeton's Matt Desmond say answering even the simplest questions about the rental market is almost impossible.
It's kind of hard to know who owns a city and who's doing the most evicting in the city. You know, I could own 1,000 properties in L.A., but they could be under 1,000 different LLC names or shell companies. And so answering really basic questions like who owns our cities, who's doing the most evicting, those are questions that we don't have great answers to.
Desmond argues we need more transparency.
Now, what would more of that kind of transparency Desmond's describing look like?
Well, if you flip the calendar back to last year, you had state lawmakers talking about this, how we need to understand more about what's going on in the rental market and to use that knowledge to create policy. Assemblymember Buffy Wicks introduced a law to create a rental database. Would have tracked basic stuff, rents, vacancies, ownership, and evictions at rental complexes, but spoiler alert, that law didn't pass.
And why did it not pass?
Well, landlord groups were strongly opposed to it. They have a lot of sway in the state house, and so we as the public still don't know that much about the rental market, and neither do the government agencies that are tasked with keeping tenants safe. Even that proposed database wouldn't have tracked code violations.
So this lack of oversight you've been reporting on, what does this mean for landlords?
Well, it allows mega landlords like Mike Niger and Palma Management to continue to rent units in states of disrepair with sometimes dangerous conditions. The penalties they face don't encourage proper maintenance and repair. Violations can just continue if they get reported. And tenants don't always report because they can be afraid. Also, being regulated in different jurisdictions by different agencies who don't talk to one another means that some landlords can profit and profit while they fly under the radar.
All right. That's KPCC's investigative reporter, Aaron Mendelson. Thank you for this. This story is part of an in-depth report we're calling Stuck. You can find the full story on LAist.com. Aaron's story continues on air all week as well. If you have questions about what you've heard about low-income housing and regulation in California, you can call us at 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. Leave your question on our voicemail and your name, and we will try to answer it on air later this week. Moving on, COVID-19, the name for a coronavirus originating from China, has infected more than 40,000 people. More than 1,000 people have died. In the U.S., only 13 cases have been confirmed, and there's been no deaths, and health officials in Southern California want to keep it that way. With more on how the virus is affecting our region, we have KPCC's Robert Garoba. Robert, welcome.
Hey, Josie.
So how many cases do we have in California right now?
So we've got 7 cases in California right now. Like you said, that's out of 13 cases nationwide. Only one of those cases is in LA County, though, and that was a traveler who actually lives in Wuhan City.
I want to ask you about your experience yesterday. You were at the March Air Reserve Base for the release of some quarantined patients. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so there were 195 people quarantined there at March Air Reserve Base. All of them were cleared to go home yesterday. They passed final health checks. They were loaded on buses behind the fences there at the base. The Riverside County Health Officer actually took this really great picture of some of them throwing their face masks up in the air like it was a graduation.
Saw that. That was quite an image.
Yeah. Dr. Nancy Knight, she was the CDC's field team lead during the quarantine. She was there, you know, during the whole 2-week thing. She said it's cause for a huge celebration. It's the first U.S. quarantine in more than 60 years that was you know, now pulled off. She did denounce discrimination, though, at a presser there yesterday. She said some people who work on the base have been stigmatized because people are, fearful of getting infected. Things like kids of workers getting called names at school, other instances she brought up. And then there was also Jamie Fouse. He's the Wuhan Consul General. He helped organize the evacuation from China. He was also there. He was one of the people that was under quarantine for 2 weeks. He got pretty emotional, at the end of this, whole ordeal. He said, he had made friends and he hoped that they could have a reunion soon.
Now, remind us, were these the only folks who've been quarantined in California, or are there others?
There are others. There are people also quarantined at Travis Air Force Base in Northern California, and then also Marine Corps Air Station in Miramar.
Oh, actually, with Miramar, there's been some confusion there, right, about someone who fell ill?
Yeah, that's kind of a confusing story. This morning, the CDC's Nancy Messonnier tried to clarify some of that. The clearest way of saying it is that the latest case, so number 13 in the U.S., was quarantined at Marine Corps Air Station in Miramar. That person was misidentified initially, and that led to a negative COVID-19 reading. They did a second test, and the person was confirmed to be positive. So, you know, the CDC says that they're putting additional measures in place to make sure that that does not happen again.
So that's the 13th case. Robert, I realize you have done a lot of reporting about COVID-19 because I remember your story about a local couple from Santa Clarita that's also been caught up in this virus scare. They were on a quarantined cruise ship in Japan. Is that right?
Yeah, I talked with Carl Goldman earlier this week. He and his wife, Jerry Cerati Goldman, they're stuck on the Diamond Princess, which is docked in Yokohama right now. They own a local radio station in Santa Clarita. They've been doing updates on their website there. They're also doing Facebook Live updates from the room, showing stuff like washing their clothes in the bathtub, getting meals delivered to their door, that sort of thing. They're really calm throughout the ordeal, it seems like. There's been 175 cases covering passengers and crew on the ship. Carl told me they got thermometers provided to them, and every time one of them coughs or sneezes or something, they're going to that to just make sure they don't have a fever. But they're all good right now.
Right, the couple that takes its temperature together.
Yeah.
With just about half a minute left, how worried are public health officials about COVID-19 right now in Southern California?
So all the public health officials continue to say that the risk to the general public is still very low. Dr. Ferrer spoke to Board of Supervisors yesterday. She seemed to be more worried about cultural, economic impacts of this. She does not want anybody to be discriminated against, and she wants people to still go to markets and businesses in the Asian American community.
All right. Robert Garova has been covering the impact of COVID-19 spread in our region. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
So the Oscars are over, but the Oscar glow effect is just getting started. Parasite made history when it won Best Picture, and industry insiders say its victory is going to have a long-range effect on world cinema. Also, remember the movie The Hunt? It's about some rich folks who have a hunt for right-wing conservatives. That story was delayed, but now it's back on. We find out why. Stay tuned. Right back with Take Two, and we have with us now Nick Roman to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hey, Nick.
Hi, Josie. We're going to look back at the New Hampshire primary results and ahead to the Nevada caucuses and the South Carolina primary. They're next on the schedule, followed by California and all the Super Tuesday states on March 3rd. KPCC Sharon McNary will have a story on today's homeless camp cleanup at Echo Park Lake, and we will also review the new album from Jackson Browne. He took a trip to Haiti to donate music recording gear, and that inspired Let the Rhythm Lead. That's the name of his new album. And you know, Josie, Jackson Browne grew up in Fullerton, went to Sunny Hills High School.
I always can count on you to know all the local trivia.
Thank you. All right. And all of it comes up on All Things Considered at 4, right after Marketplace at 3, in the frame at 3:30.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Time now to go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
This week, how Parasite's historic big picture win could change the game for global film business. Plus, remember the film The Hunt? The satirical thriller was pulled from release last summer in the wake of mass shootings, but it just got a new release date in March. The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our guide. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi there.
About a month before Parasite became the first non-English language film to win Best Picture, writer-director Bong Joon-ho said this via his now famous translator, Sharon Choi, during the Golden Globes when he accepted the award for Best Motion Picture.
Once you overcome the one-inch-tall barrier of subtitles, you will be introduced to so many more amazing films.
What does Parasite's win mean for international filmmakers and distributors, Rebecca?
Well, I can tell you what they hope it means, and that is that this sort of aversion that American audiences have had for subtitles is fading away. I mean, the conventional wisdom has been that both Oscar voters and average filmgoers in the U.S. do not want to have to watch movies with subtitles, that they just won't pay them any mind. The fact that Parasite not only won Best Picture, but it's made $35 million domestically, and that number is only going to grow, feels encouraging to other international filmmakers and distributors.
Yeah, talk about this notion, this reputation American moviegoers have about being resistant to subtitles. Do you think that's actually changing with films like Parasite?
Well, look, I mean, one thing that is unique is the enormous quality of Parasite. Not every director is Bong Joon-ho, who has an enormous international following, not to mention his star status within the cinema world in South Korea. But there is evidence that people are sort of becoming more open to subtitles in the U.S., not only in the performance of Parasite, but also thanks in part to Netflix. Netflix has an enormous amount of international content, subtitled content, that American audiences are discovering and watching. Maybe they watch an American version of the show and then they go find a European original. And that is kind of, it seems, breaking down this barrier.
Now, Parasite isn't the first Asian film to strike box office gold and win awards. I know we've seen this before. What comes to mind?
Well, it's been almost 20 years. Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon won 4 Oscars in 2001, though not Best Picture. And it earned $213 million worldwide. That was a very different kind of movie. It was a martial arts movie. It relied more on spectacle, whereas Parasite, I think, relies more on its kind of writing and its ideas. And typically, those kind of movies, it's harder for them to travel, the kind that Parasite is. But it's interesting. I mean, the world is a lot smaller than it was 20 years ago when Ang Lee made that movie. And the film industry is a lot more global than it was when Ang Lee made that movie. So I feel like if Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out now, it would be an enormous phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And it was a hit back then, but as you mentioned, it didn't win a Best Picture Oscar. So do you think that Parasite's success will have a bigger impact then on world cinema than Crouching Tiger did?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, for one thing, the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was pitching a different academy. The academy has changed a lot in 20 years. It's much, much more international. There are many more voters from around the world than there were then, and there's much more openness to international film. But in Parasite's case, I mean, they're already expanding based on this Best Picture win. They're doubling the number of theaters they're in. They're going to be in, I think, 1,800 theaters this coming weekend. On Monday alone, they made $500,000 at the box office. Both Amazon and iTunes list Parasite as the number one movie rental on their home viewing site, which I personally have never seen for a subtitled movie.
Wow. Well, I want to stay with the Oscars, but talk about a moment involving a much more maligned film that has a group of people very upset. On Sunday night during the Oscars, actors Rebel Wilson and James Corden from Cats presented the award for Best Visual Effects dressed as their characters from Cats. And here's a clip.
As cast members of the motion picture Cats,
nobody more than us understands the importance of good visual effects.
So clearly, there's a dig there at the visual effects for the musical, and the audience was eating it up, but not everybody was. Who got upset, Rebecca?
Yeah, the visual effects artists did not love this joke. It did, I have to say, go over well at the bar in the Oscars lobby that I happened to be in. People laughed very hard. But on Monday, the Visual Effects Society released a statement urging the Academy to, quote, properly honor the craft of visual effects and all the crafts. Essentially, they feel like visual effects artists were the butt of the joke. Mm. And the Academy's sort of intention is to honor all of these crafts, not just to put on an entertaining show. This is one of those moments where I think you see the challenge in walking that line.
All right. Well, visual effects are probably also part of this next movie I want to discuss with you. It's making its way to theaters after being pulled from its slated release in the wake of mass shootings.
We have an opportunity here to teach these people. These are not real people.
They're actors.
You wanted it to be real, so you decided it was.
That's from the trailer of The Hunt. Rebecca, remind us what this film is about.
The Hunt is a satire that follows 12 strangers who discover that they've been chosen to be hunted in a game devised by a group of rich elites. Last summer, just as the trailer for The Hunt was circulating, a trailer that sort of showcased the violence in the movie, there were two mass shootings in the U.S. Universal began to back off its marketing of the film, and conservative pundits took up the issue, with eventually even President Trump tweeting about it disparagingly. That caused Universal to pull the movie from its release calendar.
But now it sounds like Universal is leaning into the controversy.
Yeah, indeed. Their marketing, I would say they're going with candor in their marketing. The new poster for the film says, quote, "The most talked about movie of the year is one no one's actually seen. Decide for yourself."
Mm. So The Hollywood Reporter spoke with The Hunt's producer Jason Blum and screenwriter Damon Lindelof. The film's gotten a lot of heat and they have a defense. What is it?
Blum and Lindelof feel like the movie was misunderstood amid the controversy. They defend it as an over-the-top, satirical take on the divided state of the union. And they say that it's even-handed in its send-up of the opposing factions. And the movie just became kind of a political football in August in a way that they didn't anticipate.
So this is not the first time a film has been mired in controversy before it's even been released. Typically, when that happens, how does a film fare?
There have been a number of movies that have been mired in controversy and get released anyway, and the dust settles. I'm thinking, for instance, of this year's Joker movie, which was expected in some ways to provoke violence. There were people who were upset about the movie, family members from the Aurora, Colorado shooting several years ago who were concerned about it. The movie came out in theaters. It made more than $1 billion. It got good reviews. It was nominated for 11 Oscars. And ultimately, there was no violence in the theaters or around the film. Another movie that had a similar issue was Fight Club, which came out right around the time of the Columbine, one of the first high school shootings. And again, controversy, people worried about the violence in the film. Ultimately, the movie was just remembered as a strong, interesting film.
All right, Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the business side of entertainment. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
So, music lovers and audiophiles, I need you to brace yourself. The vinyl record industry is having a very rough week. A few days ago, a huge fire in Riverside County wiped out the industry's most important supplier. Now you have major record labels like the one run by Jack White of the White Stripes wondering how they're going to put out their albums. We talked to a Desert Sun reporter about where the industry is headed next. Take two, back in a few minutes. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. For some music lovers, there may be no lovelier sound than this. No need to adjust your radio. That's just the warm crackle of a vinyl record. For decades, many thought records had gone the way of the dodo, but a resurgence in demand has given new life to an old industry. Over 16 million LPs and EPs were sold in 2018, racking up nearly $420 million in sales. And all that might begin to explain why vinyl producers are worried this week after a catastrophic fire in Banning devastated one of two lacquer plants in the world. For more on what the loss means for the vinyl industry, let's talk to Brian Bluesky. He's arts and entertainment reporter for the Desert Sun. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
So the lacquer plant is owned by Apollo Masters. Brian, can you explain to us how lacquer is used in the creation of vinyl records, and why exactly is it so important?
Well, the lacquer is an aluminum plate covered in cellulose nitrate, and basically a lathe carves the music's grooves into a plate, which is the lacquer. From there, they're able to press many of the records using that lacquer.
So what do we know about the fire that swept through the plant? Any word on how much was lost exactly?
According to our breaking news reporter who checked this morning, the building has been declared by Banning to be a total loss. So it's hard to say because Apollo has not responded as to whether or not they're going to continue or not, and they haven't made themselves available for comment, but from what we know, the building is a total loss as of today.
Wow. So I understand the factory got their record pressing equipment from Capitol Records in the 80s. That's all gone now.
That's correct.
So some 40 years after that happened, just how much of the vinyl market was Apollo servicing?
According to Gil Tamazian, who owns Capsule Labs, he said it's about 80% of the masters were made with Apollo lacquer.
So that leaves 20% of the vinyl market somewhere else. Who else was doing it besides Apollo?
There's a company in Japan called MDC. They're also making lacquer. And one of the things that Gil told me is he already established an account with them, but they're not really taking any more new clients or new orders. So it really leaves a big question mark as to what the industry is going to do now.
And I'm just curious, how did we end up with only two lacquer suppliers in the entire world?
Well, probably because of the way that the vinyl market is. The vinyl market, it's growing now, but it was almost non-existent for a long period of time. Now, as it's starting to come back into resurgence, it's not surprising that there's only two suppliers of lacquer in the world.
And so now we have this situation where record producers are depending on these two suppliers. How are they going to be affected by the loss of the larger one? I mean, how are they taking this news?
They're concerned. If Ben Blackwell from Third Man Records is concerned, it's bad.
And you mentioned this producer. If he's worried, why is that something to pay attention to?
Well, Third Man Records, Jack White opened of the White Stripes. He opened that in his hometown of Detroit. And what he wanted to do was press records. And it was one of the few new vinyl producers in the country. And he puts out hundreds of records a year. So they need those masters. You know, if Third Man Records is panicking, there's definitely a problem.
So right now there are a lot of questions about whether Apollo will try to rebuild. We're not able to get any comment from them. So there's a lot of questions about that. So do we know if they'll even share the technologies they've developed if they decide not to rebuild?
That's a good question because it's their intellectual property. I highly doubt they're going to share it. You know, from my perspective, I would hope that they would to basically continue the industry. So there's interest in this part of the market, and I would hope that they would share their property or possibly figure out a way to keep the industry going.
Are you a fan of vinyl records yourself?
I am. I didn't start buying them till about 5 years ago. For me, it's an experience because you get the whole artist. The album art is always better with an LP because it's bigger and you get to see more of it. There's something about the sound of a vinyl record. You know, when you played that cackle at the beginning here, and, you know, that's a very pleasant sound to me. You know, some of the pops on the older records that I find in vintage stores, it sounds wonderful. And, you know, that's part of the personality of a vinyl record.
Ryan, you're certainly in a unique position as a fan and someone reporting on a very dire development for vinyl records. Brian Blue Sky is the arts and entertainment reporter for the Desert Sun. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
Summer, the final season of the long-running Netflix series Orange is the New Black was released. The show, known for tackling sensitive and topical issues, featured storylines about immigration and included a reference to a real-life source for detained immigrants to get legal help.
I found this group online. It's called Freedom for Immigrants, and they want to help people in here.
They have this number to call so you can get a lawyer, a free lawyer to come talk to you.
But you have to be careful, though, okay? Apparently, if they figure out that you're using the hotline, Big Brother shuts it down.
Well, 2 weeks later, life imitated art. And echoing that plot line, the National Immigration Detention Hotline was shut down. It had been a free and confidential resource for immigrants since 2013 and had been used by detainees until the Netflix show brought it to the attention of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In December, the nonprofit behind the hotline, Freedom for Immigrants, filed a lawsuit demanding that ICE bring back the resource. And yesterday, a court ordered the agency to restore it.
Our hotline was, and now with this order, will be again a lifeline to the outside world for people in immigration detention.
That's Christina Fiallo, co-founder and executive director of Freedom for Immigrants. She says the court's decision sets a precedent to prevent ICE from retaliating again in the future.
This case should remind us all that the Trump administration is not a law unto itself, but rather accountable to the people and our Constitution. And we are so thrilled that we are going to be able to again be in contact with our friends and family in immigration detention.
And as of right now, the hotline is officially up and running again. And that's it for Take Two on this Wednesday. I'm Josie Huang, been sitting in for A. Martinez. We'll talk to you tomorrow.